everybody. Welcome back. Good to see all of you. I just wanted to say quickly, thank you all for your patience in my audio. I'm hoping I'm in a good setup here calling in through the phone so that we don't have glitches, but you'll let me know if something is off. I don't know why. For this class in particular, the sound sometimes cuts out. But thank you for your patience. We are in the midst of exploring Mashal in the Midrash Eicha Rabba. We started last week an exploration of Mashal, parable, some kind of analogy. We have in this Midrash concrete stories that often involve a king as a central character. That king is generally God. And we talked last week in particular about how a mashal, or drawing some kind of analogy to something concrete, is a reach to try to make the inexpressible a little bit more concrete or expressible, and that will probably have some level of working in expressing some aspect of our sense of loss. It could even work in a lot of different ways at once. And also at the same time, any attempt to draw some sort of analogy will also leave us feeling a bit at a loss, so to speak, in our awareness that that analogy isn't perfect, doesn't completely capture an experience that we might be facing and that feels incomprehensible. Okay, so I just wanted to start with a few minutes of sharing some thoughts that came out through the chat last week and afterwards in some messages I got from students, participants. Last week, we focused on Mashal, where Israel is described as God's wife in some respect. And we focused on the word ke almana, that Israel was left like a widow, and how the Midrash does a lot with that one little letter, kaf. Israel isn't fully a widow, isn't fully abandoned and alone, is only like a widow. There's some sense of that sort of extremity of that metaphor not being there completely. There's a little bit of distance from the severity of that metaphor of being like a widow. And we saw a number of different rabbinic models for thinking of Israel as that wife who is not quite abandoned. We saw one telling is that Israel is like a woman whose husband has died, and she's waiting for levirate marriage to take place. So she's in a state of limbo, waiting for levirate marriage. And that model seems to point towards the picture here of some kind of natural loss. There's no blame, no finger being pointed at the source of this loss. There's also no sense of punishment for the state that this ke almana, that this woman who's like a widow, is in. So there was that kind of natural loss on the one hand. And then we saw the case of the husband who gives and takes back a writ of divorce in response to his wife's sort of wrongdoing, guilt, traitorous behavior, and yet the wife's hypocrisy in still turning to the husband. So betrayal on the one hand, and yet expecting support, right? Like Israel betraying God with idolatry and yet expecting miracles. So that focused on the wife's guilt and hypocrisy, and also on the husband's anger or even abuse. So that the kind of tenor of that ki almana, that like a widow state, was a bit different. And then we spent the bulk of our time talking about the metaphor where Israel is like a woman whose husband is not dead, but is far away, away at sea. And Akiva Mattinson guided us through a number of different valences that kind of metaphorical reading could have. On the one hand, it could be that the husband or God, that God's motives could be about tending to the material needs of the family, tending to the needs of the wife by being away at sea, like a merchant who has to go far away. And that husband / God might be longing for return and provide some sort of token as a reminder. So there's a sense of maybe being closely connected even while in a state of distance. And then on the other hand, we saw versions of that where the husband's motives were acting out of anger and being fed up with the wife. And on the other hand, in terms of the wife's experience, we saw there could be loving anticipation of return, the expected reward and blessing. On the other hand, we saw versions where this ki almana, this state of being like a widow but not fully a widow, is actually a state of paralysis and being chained, her desperate quest to find that husband who is elusive and not really interested in return. Okay, so I just wanted to recap what we saw there last week and close with one question that was emerging quite a bit over chat, and I had some follow-up with my teacher and colleague, Rav Aryeh Bernstein, on one gap in the story there about the almost widow, is that the thing that gives her hope in the Midrash that we saw is her waiting to receive the reward of her ketubah that would be so large and so great. And we talked about how that was a little bit confusing because actually a ketubah kicks in when the husband is in fact gone, is out of the picture, when the husband either dies or gives a divorce. And it was a little bit strange that the wife is actually holding out for the blessing of the ketubah, right? What does that say about where God is? We said maybe it's more like a bridal gift rather than a ketubah, that these are gifts brought into the marriage. But that also doesn't really work, because if it was a gift already given, then how does that inspire her and give her a source of hope in waiting for the husband's return? So I wanted to just share one thought that Rav Aryeh Bernstein shared with me, which is, if you take this mashal seriously, if you take this midrash seriously, it seems like the woman in it is actually holding out for the blessing that comes when the husband is in fact out of the picture, in a sense. And we might understand this sort of relationship as almost more parental, where God being somewhat out of the picture isn't necessarily indicative of abandonment, but reflects more of a kind of mature stage in this relationship we have with God. Perhaps something like a parent who passes away, where you're sort of carrying on the legacy and can reap promised blessing when we fill out that legacy, or when we fulfill the legacy of Torah. So a lot of complexity there, but I did want to share that that interpretation in particular, B'Shem Omro, in the name of Ari Weinstein. Okay, I hope we have a sense here of how these concrete and often concrete examples of familial relationship can really be quite complex and multivalent. So we're going to turn today to a different familial relationship, namely the father and son, and a different midrash, which David Stern, in his book on midrash, also discusses at some length. Okay. So I'm going to shift to screen share mode. We'll read through this midrash. I'm hoping we can do a bit of some interactive response via chat in a nice focused and targeted way. So get ready, if you're on your computer, get ready to share some thoughts on chat as a way that we can hear each other's insights a bit more. Okay, so yes. Okay, so I'm just getting one message here that what we're sort of suggesting as the radical reading of the Midrash about the woman who is somewhat abandoned with God away at sea is that, yeah, maybe God isn't really in the picture in any kind of close and intimate way, but that doesn't shut down the possibility of living out God's legacy through Torah and the practice of prayer. Okay, you can mull that over. All right, I'm going to shift to screen share. You also have, you've received it in the chat if you'd like to link to it. I'm going to open it just right here. Okay. Here we go. Okay, so here we are, session 4. And our title for today is Unresolved Parables, Take 2. So in case you felt like we hadn't quite gotten to the bottom of things last week, that's somewhat the point. We have our parables that are not giving any simplistic and straightforward meaning, but leaving us in a state of feeling somewhat unresolved still. Take two, the son in his bridal chamber. Okay. Okay, here we go. So we've sort of been marching through the chapters of Eicha and Eicha Rabba. So we're going to take an example here that is coming from chapter 4 for our fourth session. Okay, so we're in the verse 11 of chapter 4. Kila Adonai et chamato shafach charon apo vayatzet esh b'tzion v'tochal yesodoteha. So Hashem has accomplished his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger, and he has kindled a fire in Zion, which has devoured the foundation thereof. That is the verse we will be talking about. And I brought to you right off the bat here the section from Psalms that's going to be our verse from afar that we will bring back home. Okay, see, there's some people are having trouble accessing the link. We'll make sure that's ready for you. Meanwhile, you can follow along on screen share. Okay, so we're going to go to a verse from Psalm 79. If any of you were in the Psalms class with Rabbi Shai Held, I'm not sure that he talked about this one, but it's one of the songs of lament that is quite harsh. We'll just read a bit of this. I actually would love for someone to be a reader of this Psalm of Lament, just to read the first seven verses. Any takers? You can do your raise hand function.
Sure, I'll read.
Okay, go ahead. Read it in the English with a sense of lament.
A song of Asaph. O God, the heathens are come into thine inheritance. They have defiled thy holy temple. They have made Jerusalem into heaps. They have given the dead bodies of thy servants to food and to fowls of the heaven, the flesh of thy saints unto the beasts of the earth. They have shed their blood like water around about Jerusalem, with none to bury them. We are become taunt to our neighbors, a scorn and derision to them, and are round about us. How long, O Lord, wilt thou be angry forever? Wilt thou be angry forever? How long will thy jealousy burn like fire? Pour out thy wrath upon the nations that know thee not, and upon the kingdom that call not upon thy name. For they have devoured and laid waste his habitation.
Okay, thank you. So the last two lines may be familiar from the Seder, Shafoch Chamatcha. You can see where that is coming from in this psalm, right? Not turning to God to pour out God's anger from nowhere, but coming from this buildup of all that these other nations have done to us. Okay, so I was going to ask you to sort of rate on a scale from 1 to 10, how complete is the devastation described here, where 0 is not particularly devastating and 10 is quite devastating. Can put in the chat if you'd like, what number would you sort of put on a scale of the description of devastation described in this psalm? Okay, being a 9, 10, 7 to 8, I could have done this as a poll, I suppose. 9s and 8s, okay. 10 corpses unburied, that's pretty severe, the description that we have here. I'm curious if our Dane, I'm not sure if that's how we pronounce your name, Dane, who rated the 7 to 8, want to share anything on why you decided on 7 to 8 as opposed to a higher number?
I think I was basing it on like what is still left in Jerusalem and our connection to Jerusalem as opposed to our entire, if everyone were to have, and not just the the heathen, but not just the people who have ruined it, but all of the Jews had forgotten Jerusalem, and nothing was left. I would have maybe put it higher.
Okay, so right, interesting. Like maybe in the moment this feels like a 9 or a 10, but actually it's kind of retrospectively to see this psalm in the history of knowing that there's still some connection to Jerusalem could maybe make it a little bit less horrible or horrific. Okay, so we're going to see what the Midrash does with this, but I wanted to share right that context for our starting off point. And I would say also, we have the verse in Eicha that we started off with, Kila Adonai et chamato shafach haronapo vayaset eish b'tzion v'tochal yesodoteha. I think there's a way of reading that verse as describing sort of total and utter devastation, right? Kila, and you have in the translate here to accomplish. It can also mean to finish off. The foundations have been consumed. It seems like it has been burned down to the foundation. So a sort of complete destruction. So we're going to see what the Midrash does with what may sound like a pretty devastating loss. Okay, I'm going to read this Midrash in full. I'm going to ask for reactions to particular parts. And we're going to explore different pieces of this parable based on a number of intertext, so some other rabbinic texts that can shed light on what is happening in this Midrash and what is not happening in this Midrash. Okay, here we go. Vayaset ish b'tzion v'tochal yesodoteha. God has kindled a fire in Zion which has destroyed its foundation. Ketiv, it is written, we have our verse from Saul. Mizmor la'asaf, a song to Asaf. God, nations have come upon your inheritance. Okay, so just the juxtaposition model of Midrash, taking one verse, reading it in light of another verse. The Midrash says, Mizmor, b'chiyami ba'ele, a song. What do you mean this is a song of Asaf? It shouldn't be called a song of Asaf. It should be called a lament of Asaf. B'chiya le'asaf, not Mizmor le'asaf. Okay, so maybe it's sort of a bad question stylistically because we have right, Mizmor is just sort of a common motif in how psalms are introduced. But I think we can understand if we have the word Mizmor to describe psalms that are about praise and thanksgiving and joy, then how could we have the same word introduce a psalm where the content is so sad and devastating? Okay, so this is really just on that title of the psalm. Okay, here we go. This is our, right, we start with something that's unresolved. We have a textual problem. We have a textual problem that is the starting point of our Midrash. We're going to have a parable now come in, a mashal, that should, at face value, help us resolve a textual problem. Amar Rabbi Elazar, mashal lemelech, she'asa chupa livno, tikein beito, yida, v'siyeda, v'tira. So we have a parable, a king made a wedding chamber, a chuppah, for his son, right? This isn't like the kind of wedding chamber chuppah that we think of, that you just have some poles and a talit on top. This was actually a chamber that had walls. I was once at an exhibit in the Israel Museum that had sort of models of the ancient wedding chambers. It had walls. It was meant to be a place for the bride and groom to live, certainly for at least a week after the wedding. So he prepared this house, cemented it, plastered it, and decorated it. And I don't know, I think this decorated it, Sierra, like to draw, you can think of if anybody has been to Rome or seen sort of pictures of the ruins of Pompeii. There was the kind of painted, the walls were painted sometimes quite intricately with design. So I think that's what we want to picture here. All right, so that's our setup. He prepares this bridal chamber and makes it beautiful. Then what happens? The conflict of this story is extremely succinct, as it often is in Midrash. Pa'amachat hichiso v'sitra. Well, then there was a time where the son angered the king, and so he destroyed the bridal chamber. Okay, that's our conflict in our story. real pedagogue, Yoshevim is Amir. The wake of this destruction, the pedagogue commenced to sit and sing. That was the response to this destruction. Amar le hamelech harav beito ve'ata Yoshevim is Amir. So the king says to him, his house was destroyed and you are sitting and singing? Amar lehu, lekach ani mizamer, sheshafach hamatzel al chupat bino velo al bino. He said to him, this is why I'm singing, since he spilled his wrath on his son's wedding chamber rather than on his son. So we have that structure of the wedding chamber, the chupa, as a sort of punching bag, as it were. Okay, that's our mashal. Now we're going to bring this back to our verse. Kach amru la'asaf, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hachriv et mikdasho, v'ata yoshevu mezamer. So too, they said to Asaf, the Holy One has destroyed his sanctuary. You're sitting there and singing? Amar lahem, v'kach ani mezamer, sheshafach HaKadosh Baruch Hu chamato al itzim v'avanim below al Yisrael. He said to them, this is why I'm singing, since the Holy One spilled his wrath on wood and stone, rather than on Israel. So that's why it's written in our verse in Eicha, God kindled a fire in Zion, which has destroyed its foundation. Okay, so the foundation here being like destroying the chuppah. Okay, that is what we get here. We're seeing a lot of responses, such as, this is deeply troubling. What do you mean? Of course Israel dies. In this very psalm that we have from Asaf, it describes, as we mentioned, the very disturbing picture of piles of corpses. Of course, people are dying. What could possibly be motivating this midrash to tell this revisionist story, as we're seeing from Daniel in our chat? What are we supposed to be gleaning out of this? Okay. Let's see. Mfish, do you want to say one other word on what is so deeply troubling? Don't have to. Just give that comment in the chat.
It's hard for me. It seems like the Midrash is prioritizing the survival of the people, Israel, as like, oh, and sort of glossing over the fact that individuals are in the wake.
Okay, so I think if I understand correctly, right, what you're saying in that comment is, but of course people died. Eicha is full of stories of people suffering and dying, and that psalm is also, it must be that the only way that the Midrash makes this leap is that it acknowledges that, but the son, the life of the son here represents something different than just the life of an individual. Maybe it represents the people as a whole. Okay, but that does feel troubling, right? How can it just sort of gloss over the devastating loss of human life here? Okay, so yes, that is a powerful question and problem here. We have also a couple of comments here on the nature of the king seems to be quite temperamental, capricious. So what is that supposed to do to our sense of God and the nature of the divine? That is another good question here. And we have another sort of comment here, like, well, maybe something that's motivating this midrash is to try to find some sense of hope and survival in the face of loss. Okay, what I would like to do is open up, sort of focus our chat and reactions to one bit at a time. So, so I wanted to first open up in the chat for people to respond to, or maybe especially ask questions about the line in the story that sets up the conflict. Pam achat hichiso v'sitra. Once, the sun angered the king, and so the king destroyed the bridal chamber. I just want to invite responses or questions to that line itself. Once he angered the king, and the king destroyed the bridal chamber. Any questions or comments on that part? I invite you to put those in chat or raise your hand to ask questions or comments on that part. Okay, so we're seeing this is tough love. It's quite succinct, to the point, terse. Okay, Ellen is working off of the Sephardic version of Eicha Rabbah, where it says that the son went into Tarbut Ra'ah, bad culture. We're seeing a little bit of, right, some questions and maybe assumptions about what was it? What was it that made God so angry at the son? What did the son do? That is one question that we might need to ask. And an interesting question here about this whole bridal chamber setup. Who is the son marrying? And was that the source of the problem? Is this that the father didn't like the soon-to-be spouse of the son? Okay, so some questions on that. We're getting some other comments. Is this controlled or uncontrolled anger? Right? Is this sort of God acting in a rational and deliberate way, or is this does this reflect some kind of totally out of control response, or that probably has to do with that one time? Really, just one time. One time is what sets off the whole disaster. It seems very harsh. Okay. So thank you. If you haven't all glanced at these chats, I invite you to read through these chats. What I want to do is turn to a couple of different versions of the story that we find in other midrashim that will present us with some different pictures of what actually happened here that is the source of the loss and tragedy in this mashal. So I want to bring you, there's a lot of versions of this king bridal chamber motif and king destroying bridal chamber for his son motif. I want to bring you one that actually comes from the Petichta. So one of our 36, or should be 36, Petichtaot, the opening of Eicha Rabbah, number 24, has a version of this that is a little bit different. The Holy Blessed One said to the angels, come, let's you and I see what the enemies did to my house. So in the wake of destruction, God wants to check out what actually happened. Immediately, the Holy Blessed One went with the angels and Jeremiah before him. When the Holy Blessed One saw the temple, he said, for certain, this is my house. This is my resting place, that the enemies came and did as they pleased. In that moment, the Holy Blessed One cried and said, woe is me regarding my house. My children, where are you? My priests, where are you? My beloved friends, where are you? What can I do for you? I warned you, and you did not repent. Okay, so here we do see that there is a bemoaning of the loss of people as well. Banai heichan atem, kohanai heichan atem, ohavai heichan atem. We also see that there was perhaps some repeated attempt on God's part to avert this. But I want to look at this last piece that's the most relevant parallel. The Holy Blessed One said to Jeremiah, today I am like a person who had a single son. He made him a bridal chamber, and he died inside his bridal chamber. The mashal is Adam Shahayalo ben Yechidi va'asalo chupa ume betoch chupato. Ve'en lecha ke'ev lo alai v'lo al banai. Do you not feel pain for me and my children? That is the relevant excerpt here. The midrash there goes on for quite a while. But I wanted to focus in on this version of this parable, mashallah, a person has a single son, makes him a bridal chamber. He dies inside the bridal chamber, and the focus there is on pain for me and my children. What is similar and what is different about that version of this story? Oops, sorry. Okay, chat or raise hand, what seems similar and what seems different in this version of the story?
Well, he made a bridal chamber. That's the same thing. He had a single son. Instead of the bridal chamber being destroyed, his son died.
Okay, so it seems like in some ways there's a similar setup. Person makes the bridal chamber for his son. But the actual conclusion of the story is sort of the opposite. The person dies, the son dies, and the bridal chamber still exists.
And the man did not get angry. So the holy one didn't get angry.
Okay, great. And I'm seeing this in the chat as well. So Carla, Tova are... but pointing to the fact that the causation in this story is different. There's no act of angering the father, and it's not that the father does this act of destruction here. The father is encountering a tragedy that was caused externally. So it could be quite different. And again, if we go back to this, is going to be a motif over and over and over again in Midrash Eicha. How are we supposed to understand the nature of the Book of Lamentations? Is it essentially lament or is it essentially rebuke? Here, right, at least in this concise parable at the end of this Midrash, we might be more in the realm of lament, right? It's the father who discovers that his son died inside the bridal chamber and feels pain and grief rather than the father who, out of anger, actually wreak havoc and destruction himself. Okay, so that is one parallel, and I think the sort of most critical piece there, where the whole point of the Midrash that we started off with in Eicha Rabba is that the son didn't die. We see here that there are versions of this Midrash floating around where actually the son does die. Now, what do we do with that besides knowing that there are different versions of a story floating around? Well, it can lead us to read what is happening in our version of the story in Eicha Rabba, but it can lead us to probe the kind of redactional intent, right? Why choose to tell the story that the son doesn't die? We were asking that in the wake of, it seems like the book of Eicha and that psalm itself point towards the loss of human life. So why tell a story where the son doesn't die? And now we see that there were even other versions of the story floating around where the son does die. So it makes it even perhaps all the more deliberate for the Midrash that we have to go the counterintuitive route of reading this as the son living and not dying. Okay, right, the other part that is a little bit strange about this version of the Midrash is that the chuppah seems like it still exists, even though it's describing the destruction of the house and the temple, and based on the setup, it seems like the chuppah actually still exists. So those pieces are different, and we are also getting more questions around what's the deal with the bride, who's the bride, how's the bride feeling, where is she in the story? And we really have a sort of wide open gap around that. Okay.
I'm wondering, what's your hand on this? Is it symbolic of Hashem? What exactly died here?
Good. So good question. And this gets back to M. Fish's comment as well. Right, what died and what didn't die, right? We're talking about the sort of collective Israel or individuals, good good question, and we'll see as we go on if we can answer that a little more fully. Okay, so that's one parallel.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, a question.
Or make a statement. It seems to me that one is more of a concept of the one experience, the one event, but not one event, but the whole experience of over time. And that it's singular only in the sense of the word, but not in terms of what's gone on.
Okay, and, thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that the losses are a loss much greater than just the chuppah. It was like God had said in the commentary, in the Midrash, that I had warned you and you did not repent. So there was a lot going on before this actual experience took place, or this chuppah, this chamber that had been destroyed, and the chamber being the house of God.
Yeah, okay. So definitely, right, we see here, especially in parallel with this other Midrash, that sort of brings this, I warned you and you didn't repent, and which sounds like it's more than a one-time offense. Yeah, it could be that we have a kind of telescoping literary device in the Midrash that we started off with, where it, for me, the dramatic tension describes it as some kind of one-time offense, but actually it could represent generations and generations of corruption or wrongdoing. Yes. Okay, but it could be that some of what it accomplishes by telescoping that into a one-time event, besides the dramatic tension of it, is sort of emphasized that even so, even after all of that warning, from the perspective of the person experiencing the loss, it could still feel quite quite shocking, even after all that buildup. Okay, we're not going to look at a million other midrashim inside around this piece. Sorry, I'm just going to scroll to the bottom here where I made a little chart of different versions of the nature of the tragedy. So we looked at one a little bit more inside that doesn't have the anger motif. Right. So here on the left, we have our extremely terse, once he angered him and he destroyed it, that's our motif for the conflict, Necharaba. This brought you a couple of different examples. So we had already, Ellen said in her version, it has the son turned to wickedness, Tarbut Ra'ah. So just kind of filling in a gap of like, what could the son possibly have done? So that's kind of the smallest addition there to explain what happened here. But we also have other versions of this kind of story. I brought you the Talmud in Sanhedrin has a version where you have the king makes a bridal chamber, prepared a banquet with every sort of food for the son. After a few days, the son died. So there's no explanation of angering the father at all. It's just a tragedy. The son dies. The man arose and destroyed the bridal chamber. Okay, so this is something different than what we saw before. The son dies, it seems like, out of grief. The father himself goes and destroys the bridal chamber, right? And he said, I made this only for the sake of my son. Now that he is dead, what do I need his bridal chamber for? So if we want to try to understand the sudden act of destruction here, not coming from anger, but instead coming from grief, but not instead of destroying the son as we have it in our Midrash, but in response to discovering that the son is destroyed. And interestingly enough, that version of this parable, of this mashal, is brought as part of explaining why God destroyed beasts in the story of the flood, where in response to the people needing to be destroyed because they've sinned, right, God says, now what use do I have for all of these beasts? And so it explains why what seems to be a sort of superfluous or unnecessary level of destruction in the flood story, right, is explained through this mashal where the the king no longer has need for the bridal chamber, and so destroys it in the wake of his son's death. But I don't know, in the parable itself, I don't know that you have to jump to sin as part of what is driving the story forward. It seems like it's just a tragedy strikes, right? A tragedy of loss and death strikes. And so the response of grief is in and of itself quite destructive. Okay. And the last version I wanted to bring here in Bereshit Rabbah, right, also focused on the flood story. That's the basis for it, but we have a similar motif here. The king became angry at his son and killed him. He entered the bridal chamber and began to break its supports, to tear down its walls, and to rip apart its curtain. He said, "My son is destroyed, and these things still exist." Right? There's no reason for these. So a similar kind of thing here where God's destroying everything because they're no longer necessary since the son isn't there. But here we do have that motif of anger, and in kind of the most probably the most disturbing version of the story, we have quite explicitly that the king kills his son out of anger. Okay, so that is all to give us a sense of, I think two things you want to see. We have a number of different versions. I've shown you here a number of different versions where the son does die. And in the most extreme version, the son dies at the hands of his father out of anger. Right? And all of that is meant to sort of serve as a counterpoint to emphasize by way of contrast the version that we have and the direction it goes in where the son does not die. Okay, any comments, questions to that aspect of our mashal, what is the source of conflict in the story, and the nature of this loss?
Well, I find these things, it's very confusing, and I'm guessing maybe it's an expression of the confusion and chaos people felt at the time of the destruction of the temple, and they're grasping at ways to interpret this. How can we understand what's happening to us? And in the midst of this, they're using all these metaphors, which are sometimes contradictory and sometimes hard to explain.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Definitely contradictory, hard to explain. Other thoughts that are coming in through this chat here? Okay. So certainly with some level of the relationship between anger and sadness, that we have these different versions of the parable that are, they sort of have a similar plot line, and yet the thing that motivates them could be anger or tragedy. Okay, so we're getting also come here that maybe the father-son versus king-prince isn't the most simple leap to make. We know that there's a number of midrashim where there are motifs about father-son or sort of people in general that turn into a kind of paradigm and are typecast as king stories. The kings in these parables seem to be based off of the Roman emperor in some ways, but could also represent that the son of a king is meant to sort of carry on a certain legacy. There's more at stake in how that son turns out than perhaps in general. Okay. And yes, and there is, like, there's something different, sort of the emotional landscape of how we interpret this loss is different based on the different versions of the story and the kind of balance between anger and sadness. Okay. So that's the piece about the nature of the loss. I want to look for our last 10 minutes at the role of the pedagogue, who's a somewhat cryptic character here. And to do this well, I think we have time for this. Let's see. To do this well, I want to bring us, there's two other, sorry for the roller coaster here on the screen share. There's two other versions of this midrash where we see the role of a pedagogue kind of playing out differently. So one is midrash Tehillim. It's always fun. If you have a midrash on one verse and it starts off quoting a verse from somewhere else, you can see, is there a midrash on that verse in and of itself? So indeed, we do have a midrash on this opening verse in Psalms in the collection of midrashim on the book of Psalms. And we have a similar story there. It's like a king who had a son who was disobedient, didn't listen to his father. What did the king do when he was filled with anger? He entered the bridal chamber of his son, tore, ripped, and threw out the curtains until all of them had been torn, and he threw them out. The king said, "Did I not act wisely by destroying the bridal chamber for my son? For I can make a more beautiful bridal chamber for him. And by not killing him in my anger, for if I had killed him, my nephew would have succeeded me. It is better that my son succeed me." And so too, God, right, we have the Mizmor La'Asaf. Asaf is singing because the Holy One acted well by pouring out his wrath upon wood and stone and not upon his children. And there is our verse from Eicha. Okay, so it's a similar kind of message there, but we have what seems like the king acting out of total loss of control, just like smashing this bridal chamber, is actually described here as an extremely deliberate strategy on the part of the king, that the king is, it's not just sort of after the fact, you have an outside observer saying, isn't it great that the king didn't kill his son? You have the king himself intentionally focusing his anger in this way. Though obviously we still have our same questions on what do you mean all the anger is taken out on wood and stones? Aren't there also people who die in this story? But okay, so that's a sort of similar motif, but without the pedagogue. There's no pedagogue in that story. And I want to go to one other version here where the pedagogue plays a particular role that is different. Another version of this parable is found in Midrash Tehillim on the third psalm of Song when David fled from Avshalom. And this Midrash starts by saying, David composes this song fleeing from Avshalom when he was going up the Mount of Olives, ascending and weeping. The Midrash asks, if David was weeping, why was he singing? If he was singing, why was he weeping? So what's this mix of song and weeping? And now we get another version of our parable. It's a little bit different. It's like a king who got angry at his son and banished him from his palace. Okay, so we have banishment rather than destroying a bridal chamber. The king sent his pedagogue after him, and he found him weeping and singing. Right, so here we see that the king actually sends the pedagogue, and it seems like to see how the son is doing. So he expresses a certain care for his son by sending the pedagogue after him. The pedagogue asked him, "Why are you weeping and singing?" The son replied, "I am weeping because I angered my father. I am singing because he did not condemn me to death, but only to banishment. Not only did he not execute me, but only banish me. He banished me to a province of commanders and prefects." And the Midrash goes on to say that there's a history of banishment among great people. Jacob, Moshe, and Elijah were all banished. And so David feels like he's among a good set of colleagues in this experience of banishment. Okay, what I want to say here is what's interesting about the pedagogue is the pedagogue isn't the source of this insight regarding the difference, the sort of singing in a moment that seems like it would only call for weeping. The pedagogue here is an observer who witnesses the son discover this realization in and of himself that this could have been a totally devastating loss, but actually it's not, right? Actually, there is still hope. And what I want to say about this, I think here you see also that the role of the pedagogue as observer here and the absence of the pedagogue in the previous Midrash sort of emphasizes the centrality of the pedagogue in our version. So our last little chart here is on the nature of the pedagogue. And we have one other version where we have a pedagogue. This is in the middle. Actually, I think I may have mislabeled this. I'll need to fix that. Another version of this Midrash has the pedagogue in a much more active role. So we're going to follow this middle version here. A king who became angry at his son and wished to kill him. The king's courtier said to him, "I beg you, forgive him. Do not kill him." The king restrained himself and did not kill him. So here we have an actually active third party who prevents the king from killing his son. And the next day, the king began to say, "If I had killed my son, I would have injured only myself. I should thank my courtier who begged for pity for my son. From now, I will make him a father to kings." And that actually, the analogy there is Moshe interceding on behalf of the people and preventing their destruction. So we have a more proactive pedagogue in that version of the story, and actually an aversion of extreme disaster. What I want to say about this is the role of the pedagogue in our Midrash, which you have here on the left-hand column, is it seems like the pedagogue here is the source of insight and the source of a counterintuitive insight that finds some sense of hope. And in some ways, perhaps it is revisionist, but in some ways retells what is happening in this tragedy and loss so that it is not quite as devastating as it could have been. And what David Stern argues in his book on this Midrash is that the pedagogue, right, who is this pedagogue? Historically, a pedagogue was often a servant who had the particularly skilled role of training and educating children. The pedagogue in this Midrash seems to maybe represent Midrash itself. What do we mean by that? The pedagogue is this third party trying to decipher what seems to be incomprehensible and devastating, right? Both trying to resolve the problem in the parable, right? The problem in the parable that doesn't make sense is how could one be singing in the face of destruction, but also, right, trying to resolve our textual problem. How could we have that language of singing in the wake of destruction? And comes up with a kind of creative interpretation here that I would say, in the strongest terms, brings the son back to life in a certain way. We've seen the versions of this Midrash where the son dies. We have a creative exegesis that actually, kind of against all odds in terms of the straightforward meaning of the text, brings the son back to life, right? A verse that should have probably been read as utter destruction, destroying something all the way down to its foundation, becomes creatively reread as, right, as it's only sticks and stones that are destroyed. And suddenly, because of this creative midrash, there is a way to encounter what could have otherwise been a totally devastating story. So that role of the pedagogue is not quite as prominent in these other versions of the text. So I would say in some ways you have Midrash maybe functioning kind of like Moshe in this middle version of the story, where perhaps, right, in the wake of loss, what we have is we have Midrash. Right? What this Midrash leaves us with is the practice of Midrash that allows us to try to interface with, gives us some language and outlet to interface with what could be otherwise totally devastating. So just like last time, we had the Torah, we had synagogues as the kind of place we go as we're longing for God, and that provides a source of comfort and reminder of that relationship. What we have here is the tool of Midrash as the sort of medium is the message here as a pathway for us within the wake of this loss. that hopefully gives us some room to continue this relationship. Okay, thank you all for your attention and comments and insights. I always save our chat, so if I didn't relate to something you said in real time, I always appreciate reading it afterwards. And take good care, and I'll see you next week for our last session pre-Tisha B'Av.